This is an I Am Listening original podcast.
I think that localism, people bandy that word around, but I think having services delivered by people and councils at the lowest level who really do know their communities inside out is absolutely key. Yeah, I think we need to rebalance, and I think devolution has got a long way to come.
Welcome to the Kent Politics Podcast, your go-to source for insightful discussions on local and national political matters. Join us as we take a deep dive into local government across the county. Find out what the key decision makers have to say, what your money is being spent on, and how the party's policies could affect how we live. Plus, don't miss our regular feature, Westminster Watch, where we dissect the latest developments and decisions shaping the political landscape in the heart of the UK's capital. Engage with us as we delve into the issues that matter to you and explore the dynamic world of politics from a Kent perspective.
In the week, Medway schools are set to abandon single-sex status, a former policeman was banned for life, and we've revealed the true cost of special needs education. My name is Simon Finlay, local democracy reporter covering Kent County Council, and I'm joined by Robert Boddy, who looks after Medway Council.
Hello.
And Dan Essen, who covers the district and borough councils.
Hello.
And senior news editor Nikki White, who has been looking at the national and international picture.
Hello.
Later on, we'll be speaking to Green Party councillor Mark Hood about the rise and rise of his party in Kent and whether it can seize control of the county council. Robert, what's been happening down your way in Medway?
In education news this week, three of Medway's single-sex grammar schools are to go co-educational from September 2026. The plans were first floated in April 2022, with it to come into effect from September this year. But the Department for Education intervened in 2023 and put it on hold. In April this year, it went to the South East Advisory Board, who decided they couldn't make a decision, so passed it to the Minister for Education, who is now given the go-ahead.
So which schools are going to be affected by this?
So Chatham Grammar and Fort Pitt Grammar Schools for girls and Holcombe Grammar for boys are to go mixed. Originally, the reason given was that there are a shortage of selective school places for boys, but now the council says the move will make availability of spaces for boys and girls more equal and can alleviate pressure for places at non-selective schools.
Has there been any kind of reaction to this then?
Well, the schools and Medway Council have both welcomed it, saying it will mean more children from Medway will get places in local schools rather than children from outside the area, and it will mean that children will not have to travel as far to get to school. However, Kent education expert Peter Reed says he's not seen much from parents who will actually be affected by this change, saying they haven't driven this move and don't seem that bothered either way by it. He says he's not for or against it and agrees it will alleviate pressure on non-selective schools, but he says there are bigger issues in education at the moment, so it seemed a strange priority.
Dan, what have you been looking at this week?
I've actually taken a brief holiday from the world of local government to over to the world of police misconduct in Maidstone, where I covered an accelerated hearing into the life and times of former Kent police officer Thomas Smith, who would have been dismissed at the meeting I was at last week had he not already resigned and been to prison.
Okay, so what does the guy do then?
So in December and January last year, the then PC Smith, who was an officer of 8 years, was caught speeding along the A20, presumably near London, because it was the mayor who spoke to him. They caught him four times. One time he admitted, the later three of them, when Met police officers confronted him about it, he said that wasn't him, that his car must have been cloned, which, you know, when people make a copy of your number plate and put it onto a similar looking car, and also then went and put stickers on his own number plate so that it didn't look like the one that was caught flooring it on CCTV. He maintained that facade for a little while, but then the police say they were informed of the truth by anonymous intelligence sources, which presumably other Kent officers telling on him, and the Met came and asked him and he fessed up.
Okay, so what happened to him when he was found out?
So despite obviously going to quite some effort to try and basically fabricate a narrative about him not being the one in control of the car at the time, he fessed up as soon as he was caught, and he resigned from his position as a police officer pretty quickly, and he ended up securing himself a tidy 8-month prison sentence, which I believe he's now been released from. He was sentenced for perverting the course of justice at Croydon County Court, and despite already going down for that, he got served his police misconduct hearing papers in the prison canteen, which is a rep from the Police Federation wasn't very happy about.
I dare say he wasn't. So what did Kent Police find, and what did he have to say for himself in the defence?
Well, he didn't attend the misconduct hearing himself, and he said through his representative from the Federation that he attended, he chose not to attend because he knew exactly what was going to happen, was that he was found guilty, and that's, you know, he was correct in predicting that. In his statement, he said he was a good officer of 8 years' service who'd only made one very bad decision, and in that 8 years, he said he'd never taken a sick day, so when he was caught speeding, part of the reason he was speeding is because he was late and wanted to protect his 100% attendance record. But the Chief Constable of Kent Police, Tim Smith, gave this pretty short shrift and said that the public had taken an extremely dim view of what he did. And if he hadn't already been, you know, already resigned himself and gone to prison, that he would have been sacked that very day and he's been permanently banned from serving for a copper ever again.
Interesting.
What's going down at County Hall, Simon?
We ran a story this week which relates to the cost to the taxpayer of special educational needs in Kent. New figures contained in a report to the scrutiny committee at Kent County Council has revealed the price tag is rising rapidly as the number of children requiring help grows as well. And this is particularly so in the high needs block. For instance, one state pupil being educated in a private setting cost the taxpayers nearly £50,000 each, and this is contributing to a £46 million overspend year on year.
What effect is this having on the council?
Well, it's piling on enormous pressure to KCC, which must provide special education services by law, but its funding nowhere near covers what it needs to spend to provide it. So by way of example, the figures I've seen show that high needs pupil in a maintained school costs about £24,000, that's a state school, compared to, and that's in 24-25, compared to about £20,000 4 years ago, so that's 17.5% up. But if you send the same child to a private school, it now costs £49,259 this year, and next, compared to £43,734 4 years ago. So those are significant increases. And the number of kids who require what they call HMB, high needs block education, has also grown considerably as well. And this means that the higher needs budget for 24-25 is £342 million, but the cost of it is going to be £389 million. So that's where the £46 million figure comes from.
Has there been a reaction to this?
Well, one county councillor, Simon Webb, who actually is an educationalist by trade, said that the one reason why high needs pupils are in private schools is because the state special needs schools are operating what he described as a selective admissions policy, a situation that he has also described as ludicrous. He welcomes the reforms currently being carried out by KCC to reduce the cost of special educational needs and the Home to School Transport Bill.
How have the special schools reacted to this?
Well, earlier this year, they sent a letter from the Kent Special Educational Needs Trust, which was widely published, and it said that there's been a lot of rhetoric from KCC that special needs schools do not wish to change and are actively resisting change, and this is simply not the case and is causing further friction between KCC and its schools, something that it will only be detrimental to the children we all seek to serve. Nikki, what's caught your eye up in Westminster?
OK, well, we've got a new Tory party leader. And Kemi Badenoch took to the floor at Westminster this week for her first PMQs as leader of the opposition. She certainly didn't ease herself in gently. She robustly confronted Sir Keir Starmer and Rachel Reeves on their budget and also challenged the Prime Minister over his relationship with President-elect Trump. And she's refusing to mince her words. It felt like she was setting the tone for the months ahead. And if that's the case, Labour certainly won't be in getting an easy ride. Mm-hmm. So sat not too far away from her were Faversham and Mid-Kent MP Helen Whateley, who she's now the Shadow Secretary of State for Work and Pensions, and also Sevenoaks MP Laura Trott, who's been appointed Shadow Education Secretary. Both of those had supported Kemi throughout her leadership campaign and perhaps understandably were rewarded for that loyalty. Helen said it was an honour to be appointed to the post. She said the Tories are the party of work and aspiration, and that now more than ever, our country needs everyone to unleash their potential, and I'll work hard to hold this Labour government to account. Helen hasn't forgotten her constituency work, though, and she's been asking questions in the House this week about broadband black spots, particularly for the villages of Throwley and Witchling, two communities which she says have been left behind in the rollout of superfast connectivity. She's since met with Building Digital UK, that's the government arm tasked with improving faster broadband and mobile coverage in hard-to-reach places across the UK. And Helen said, "We're making progress, and I really hope to have some good news to share on this soon."
So what did Laura Trott have to say?
Laura, again, she was delighted to be appointed to her education role and said that she wanted to work constructively in opposition in the best interests of children and young people. She was, however, quick to get going in a new post and said what she actually described as quite the first day when Labour issued a statement on their decision to hike up tuition fees for the first time in several years. Laura was quick to point out this wasn't something that they'd actually mentioned in their manifesto. However, on a lighter note, she's also been appealing this week for entries for her annual Christmas card competition. And the winning design will be printed on all the cards that she sends out in December. The winner will also get a trip to the Panto at the Stag Theatre in Sevenoaks. But if you were thinking of entering, Simon, I'm afraid you have to be under 11 and the deadline's now closed.
Any other big names in Kent Tory politics get a job from new leader at Tory Party?
You might have thought that Tunbridge MP Tom Tugendhat would have been on the list for a top job, especially after he threw his hat into the ring early on as a possible party leader, but there's been no mention of him. It's understood no specific role was offered to him, and although he was actually approached by the leader of the opposition, he said he didn't want a role in the shadow cabinet.
Is there a topic that you would like to be discussed on the Kent Politics Podcast? Perhaps you've got a question for one of our panel, or you'd like to comment on a hot topic in local or national government. Get in touch by emailing or sending a voice note to kentpoliticspodcast@thekmgroup.co.uk.
The past 10 years has seen a remarkable and sustained growth in popularity for the Green Party in Kent. Perhaps driven by the explosion in house building and loss of many green spaces, or maybe disgust at the water companies dumping raw sewage into rivers or coastal waters. One man who's been around for most of it is my guest, Kent County and Tunbridge Borough Councillor Mark Hood, and he joins us today. Welcome, Mark. Thanks for being here.
Hello, Simon. I'm delighted to be here too.
Yeah, thank you very much indeed for joining us. Listen, just before we kick off, just tell us a little bit about your background, please, and how you got into politics.
Well, I've lived in Tunbridge since I was 4 years old. I was brought up in Hindwood on the painter's estate out there, and I was a printer for 25 years before I went into gardening. So printing was a massive trade industry in the Tunbridge area. But then I moved over to gardening, and then I got into sort of community grassroots kind of activities with the Bardane Residents Association. And then we had a local campaign called Keep Riverlawn Green, which kind of propelled me into more party politics. So, yeah, that's kind of my background.
Yeah. Why the Green Party and not maybe the Labour Party?
I didn't. Back in the very late 80s, I was in the anti-poll tax movement. And I didn't. When I looked around, I couldn't see any political parties that reflected my kind of hopes and aspirations and my values. And then it was weird because the Green Party were involved in that campaign to a certain extent. And over the years, I just became more aligned with them. And then almost as soon as I stopped being a printer, I had a bit more time on my hands for evening meetings because I didn't work shifts. So I went along to a few Green Party meetings and I felt that I was really part of a wider family there, a wider community. And so,
You're a Kent County councillor, and you've had to watch in the last sort of 4 or 5 years the council going through some pretty difficult times, having to find tens of millions of pounds in savings every year while services are suffering. Do you ever have a sneaking sympathy for Conservative leader Roger Gough?
I don't think that County Council is in the state that it's in because it has been historically badly run. I think it is in a state of managed decline. I think Kent Highways actually describe it as such when they talk about their road network.
Yeah, that was David Brazier. He said he got himself in a terrible lot of trouble, didn't he? Yeah,
he did. But he spoke a lot of sense. He told the truth. And I think that it's a combination of increasing demand in terms of things like social services and all the people-based services like SEND, adult social care, all of those children's services, and the fact that we don't get the money from government that we once got. So I think the two things have created the perfect storm, and they are an existential threat to the future of the County Council, which I think is a massive shame because it is such a valuable institution that contributes so much to the life of Kent's residents.
But the Conservatives have been in charge for quite a long time. In fact, as long as I can remember, really. So if you're in charge, surely you should be managing things a little bit better, shouldn't you?
You can always do things better. You can always manage things in different ways. I think the fact that the council is committed to commission services instead of running things itself, that's a huge problem. And the Conservatives are entirely culpable for what's happened because they've been in charge at the government level in Westminster as well as at County Hall. So, yeah, they're certainly at fault for the predicament that we find ourselves in entirely.
Why do you think governments, I mean, not just this government, but the last government, have been so reluctant to fund local authorities, or do you think they're still fat to trim at KCC?
I think that the county council has been, it's been cut to the bone, so there's certainly no fat there. I think that successive governments have held local government in pretty much contempt. I think that there's a we know best attitude, which still pervades. I think that the COVID period actually was a really good example of how local councils were necessary. They actually took a lot of responsibility for delivering assistance to our communities, and they did it really well. I think that localism, people bandied that word around, but I think having services delivered by people and councils at the lowest level who really do know their communities inside out is absolutely key. Yeah, I think we need to rebalance. I think devolution has got a long way to come.
You say that you think the governments hold local government in contempt. Well, if they hold them in contempt and clearly think that they could do it better, why aren't they doing it better? And why aren't they doing it themselves rather than just let sort of councils go to the wall?
Well, I think that they are, to a certain extent. I think they micromanage. Every time a council will bid for funding, it comes with loads of caveats about you can only look at the bus service improvement plan funding, that we are told in huge detail what we can and can't spend that money on, and that extends to lots of other areas of expenditure too. So what we would like to see is a proper devolution, which wouldn't include having an elected mayor, because we think that actually concentrates power in the hands of one person, and that is exactly the opposite way that we would like to see things evolve.
Yeah.
And then a county the size of Kent would be able to control a budget the size of a government department. 1.9 million people live
in... That's a small country, Kent. Really, isn't it?
Northern Ireland.
Same size.
Yeah. So we would like to see a bit more ambition. And, you know, we've got unique challenges, but give us the responsibility.
Do you think that government, central government, is just a little bit afraid of taking that plunge, or it's just the way things are at the minute, they just can't be bothered, or they haven't got the scope to take it on, that level of change?
Well, they are empowering regions, aren't they? They've empowered Andy Burnham in Manchester to take these steps. So I think there is an appetite. I think if you look at other peninsular counties like Cornwall, where they've been given devolved powers, so they've set up transport for Cornwall, which works really effectively. I think if they are serious about it, I mean, Angela Rayner at the Local Government Association the other day made a very impressive speech, apparently, saying that there was a change in attitude, and I hope that is the case.
We've got elections coming up in May. What are the big issues that the Green Party will be fighting that election on next year?
I think the biggest challenges we're going to have actually relate to the survival of the council. For KCC, they relate to all the things that are important to us, like making sure that we can keep the council intact so we can continue to deliver adult social care, SEND, transport to school, because we're concerned about the Kent Travel Saver and how sustainable that is going forward. And obviously, if you've got a selective education system, we need to be able to make sure that children are able to get to the school of their choice.
Mm-hmm.
So these things, and there's a lot of things that the council delivers which are additional. They're not core things, but they are beneficial to the people of Kent. And I don't think a lot of people realise just how much is going on in terms of social prescribing and all that kind of thing behind the scenes.
Mm, okay. Do you think that the Green Party can be the biggest party of the opposition parties currently? And do you think that the opposition parties can get enough to get a majority and dethrone the Conservatives at County Hall?
I can't see any reason why the Green Party can't be the biggest party in Kent. When you look at what's happening, we've got the Labour Party look like they're going to be a one-term administration because they haven't got the ambition to create and sustain the change that they've promised everybody that they would deliver. The Labour Party will have that issue. I think the Conservative Party have got the problem where their electorate has been split by Reform suddenly turning up and stealing their clothes. So I think that's a big issue. So I can see that right of centre, the vote being split. And I think the Green Party are well trusted in our communities. I think we've got people see us, they know that we're authentic, they know that we're absolutely embedded in our communities. They see us litter picking, they see us stewarding at events, and they know that when we're not in power, we hold the administrations to account, and when we are in power, we deliver. Mm. So I think, yeah.
So you think Reform UK could be the sort of kingmakers in that respect?
I can't see them being kingmakers. I think they have the potential to lock both themselves and the Conservatives out of power. I don't think Kent is a natural home for Reform at all. I think Kent's a tolerant community. The thing with Reform is they're very content to point out what's wrong, but when they're asked to come up with the solutions, they fail miserably. They haven't got any solutions. They're there to stoke the flames of dissatisfaction.
Why do you think the Green Party has grown in popularity and in recent years? And why do you think that a lot of Tories are prepared to vote Green, despite the fact you're fairly left of centre party?
I think if you look at what's happened with the Conservative Party, they've managed to shift so far to the right that I don't think that even people like Margaret Thatcher would recognise some of the policies that are being pushed by people like Temi Badenoch and Robert Jenrick. I think that a lot of Conservative voters feel that the party has moved away from them, and I think that's probably true of a lot of Labour supporters as well. Well, a lot of Labour members. So I think here in Tunbridge, we have a lot of people who vote for us who have previously voted Conservative, and they do it because they can see that we share their values in terms of wanting safe communities, wanting to have a sustainable housing market where we are actually building properties for our social housing so that our sons and daughters aren't priced out of our communities and forced to live elsewhere, that we place value on the natural environment and the green belt. So, I mean, even when we looked at some of the UKIP leaflets and literature, you can see that there's quite a lot of shared values between people in terms of looking after our countryside and our core values.
You mentioned UKIP there. Did you mean to mention UKIP, Mark?
I did, because we've previously had UKIP candidates here, and it was it was striking to us how often we would see in multi councillor wards that you'd see a UKIP cross next to a Green Party cross, and
so you think they're probably coming from the Conservatives.
We managed to at the last county election. The Conservative vote more or less held up here, but we managed to get a lot of voters out who had never voted before in Tunbridge. So it's kind of we took voters who had previously voted Labour and Lib Dem, and they decided that they would vote Green because they recognised what we were doing locally and our ambitions to do things differently, work collaboratively, make real change.
Okay, house building is a huge issue in this county. Do you think we're building the right types of houses?
We're definitely not building the right types of housing. What we are doing is the government's pandering to developers. And when you look at the west of the county especially, you look at Seven Oaks, Tunbridge Wells, Tunbridge Morling, where you've got districts like Seven Oaks, they've got 93% of the available land is Greenbelt, and you just cannot fit that many houses in. And if you're limited, then you need to look at where the greatest need is. And addressing local need first, I think, is the responsibility of any council. Mm-hmm. And that means looking at social housing. And a lot of councils are building social housing. A lot of them are conservative councils because they recognise that it's also an investment. If you have an independent housing company that you have an arm's length relationship with, that you can actually protect your investment by making sure it's not susceptible to right to buy, and that you can solve the problem you've got with a lot of temporary accommodation, which is going to cost Tunbridge Wells 665,000 pounds this year alone, and then you can make sure that you've got money coming in to pay for your services going forward. So I think it's critically important that you get it right, and that the government allows local councils like Tunbridge and Walling to actually focus on that kind of social housing and give us the money, provide the money for us to get on and do this kind of work.
Finally, Labour have been in for just 4 months. How would you rate the performance of Sir Keir Starmer since he came into office?
Very disappointing, I think. If you look at his performance, he's becoming a leader of the Labour Party. He has managed to backtrack on almost every one of his leadership pledges, and even the election pledges. I mean, he's got more flip flops than Canberra Sands. He's quite appalling, really. When you think of, I've got a colleague, a Labour colleague. He said to me in the past that you get a lot of leaders who break their policies once they get into power, but you don't get many who break their policies before they actually find their way into number 10 Downing Street, which he has. So it's kind of, I'm not quite sure what drives him. I don't understand what he wants to achieve, because at the moment I'm not seeing a marked difference in his policies to those of the previous government.
Okay, Mark Hood, listen, it's been a pleasure to speak with you, as always, and many thanks for your time.
Okay, thank you very much. You take care.
The election of Kemi Badenoch as the leader of the Conservative Party has been somewhat eclipsed by the United States playing its trump card and emphatically electing the Donald. What about Kemi Badenoch then, Nikki?
Yeah, it must have been pretty tough for her, gearing herself up for her first PMQs to make that iconic first moment on the lectern. But and then she's trumped by Trump, which was probably not what she wanted to happen. She came out all guns blazing, though. I think some people will say that she was, I mean, she's been described as combative throughout her whole career. She certainly set the tone for that. She came out with, there were no niceties about it, really.
Yeah, straight to it, yeah.
Yeah, absolutely straight into it. And it just feels that it wasn't a job interview for her, but you feel that sometimes if you're creating a new friendship and a new relationship, you want to kind of make sure that you're going to get on with somebody from the off.
From the off, and
have a healthy working relationship, even if you're not going to agree.
Yeah,
and
yeah.
I'm not sure that's the tone that I felt she set there. I think there's going to be lots of fireworks certainly in the next few weeks.
I think absolutely. Dan, you watched PMQs. I haven't seen it, but I mean, you've just watched it. What did you think?
And yeah, she obviously, like Nikki says, she put in quite an aggressive performance to start with, which I think is probably what most people expect. I don't think that's necessarily a bad thing. You know, they ostensibly represent different parties with completely competing worldviews. It's sometimes a bit sickening when they're all a bit too chummy with each other at PMQs. But she, a lot of it was what you might describe as party political digs at each other. But there was some hints at policy issues of substance. Like, for example, she asked if Keir Starmer would reinitiate negotiations with Donald Trump when he takes office as president in the free trade agreement, which the Biden administration scrapped when it took office, which was being negotiated by the Tories with Donald Trump's government a few years ago. But for the most part, I think it set the tone that she will try and talk about policy issues, but for the most part, her function and what she seems to have set herself up to enjoy doing is forcing the government into answering or trying to make them answer awkward questions and grabbing headlines. But when you're the leader of basically a rump opposition, I guess that's pretty much the only thing you can do.
Rob, you know, we were talking a little earlier, and so just wondering about, will she last?
I have to be honest, I don't think she'll be the candidate for the next election for the Tories. I mean, I could be wrong, stranger things have happened, but I think the leader of the opposition, particularly at this early stage, they can't really achieve that much. You know, the government is new, they're making all the changes. Leader of the opposition kind of just has to sit there at the sidelines. And I think that will, particularly with Badenoch's aggressive style will rub people a lot in the wrong way. I wouldn't be surprised if she's quite quickly accused of being all talk and not much bite. Because, you know, to be fair to her, I don't think she can achieve much, but she'll talk the big talk and people will say, well, we elected you to really stick it to Labour and they're still getting all their things through, so what are you doing? I mean, the Tory party has form on this. You know, David Cameron was not elected in 1997 to face Tony Blair and eventually winning in 2010. There were several leaders before him, which some were knifed in the back and some weren't, but I think that's definitely coming down the track, and I think it's a case of one thing I have heard a lot said from reportedly said by Conservative MPs about Kemi Badenoch. It's two things. It's either she's exactly what we need. She's a straight talker. Mm-hmm. You know, she gets right to the heart of it. And the other thing they say is she was so rude to me, I'll never speak to her again. So, I mean, over the next few years, I think one of those two sides will definitely grow and one will diminish. I'll let listeners decide which one that will be.
No, I think you're absolutely right. I think that she's entirely wrong for the position, apart from the fact that she's way too right-wing to ever be electable or to gain mass popularity, the sort of popularity you need in order to form a government. So I think she'll be toast within probably a couple of years, if not one. So we'll have to wait and see. We might have to eat our hat when Prime Minister Kemi Badenoch marches up to the dispatch box. Anyway, the other thing that happened this week, it was the election of the new President of the United States after what seems to be an absolute age of campaigning. But what does it kind of mean for Britain, Dan? You've been following this quite closely.
Yeah, I think the most important thing of what it means for Britain and Europe more generally is basically around foreign and defence policy. You know, it's no secret America is the most powerful state to have ever existed. It is, you know, basically a global hegemon, and Britain for many, many decades now has essentially been a provincial airstrip in a global American empire. Most of our foreign policy is completely dependent on America. And, like, you know, there's, for example, potentially quite a major decision facing America and Britain literally in the coming few weeks. The US-UK Mutual Defence Agreement from 1958, which makes Britain's nuclear deterrent explicitly interdependent on American technical input. We lease our missiles from them. They have a degree of oversight over our nuclear deterrent. That expires on the 31st of December this year. Technically, Biden will still be the president when that happens, but if Donald Trump expresses, as he has with issues like the Ukraine war, that he wants to, I guess, isolate America more from its sort of imperial commitments to and defence commitments to other countries, if Donald Trump signalled that he didn't want to renew that treaty, you know, Biden probably wouldn't renew it because it would cause a constitutional crisis if you predetermined your predecessor in that or your successor in that way. I think that points to something bigger, which is that Donald Trump said he wants to pull loads of money out of the war in Ukraine, which is, you know, by definition, it's a European war. It's in Europe. And it was him who led the withdrawal from Afghanistan of American soldiers. Mm-hmm. And basically, I would hope that politicians in the rest of the West realise that, you know, You have to have an independent security and foreign policy, especially when it comes to things like nuclear deterrence. The question is whether or not politicians in countries like Britain or France or Germany have the political will to realise that when for decades they've essentially been completely dependent on NATO and American patronage.
Okay, folks, that's your lot for this week. Thanks to Nikki, Rob and Dan and our special guest Mark Hood. Don't forget to keep an eye on KentOnline.com/politics for the latest news from across the county. And you can also sign up for our newly launched politics briefing newsletter by visiting kentonline.co.uk/newsletters/. And finally, don't miss KMTV's politics show every Friday at 5 p.m. See you next time.
Thanks for listening to the Kent Politics Podcast. Don't forget to check out stories throughout the week on the politics page of Kent Online. And you can watch the Kent Politics Show with Rob Bailey on KMTV every Friday at 5 p.m. or on demand at kmtv.co.uk.
This has been an I Am Listening original podcast. For more information, head over to our website, iam-listening.co.uk.